floated into his mind. If a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. Would he die today for his principles? Or had he already died years ago by pledging himself to his work and cutting himself off from others who might get close to him? If his heart stopped beating today, would it just be a belated announcement of a death that had already happened? Sometimes, at bars or conferences or weddings, he met women who were impressed by his bravado. They asked if he was worried about violence at clinics, and he shrugged it off. He'd say, "Life is fatal. None of us are getting out of here breathing." It was easy to make that joke in response to a hypothetical question. But now? He did not want to die. But if he did, he hoped it would be swift and not lingering. He did not want to die. But if he did, he believed he'd been as good a man as he could have been. He did not want to die. But if he did, he would have gotten more time than Malcolm or Martin had. And yet, God damn it, he wasn't finished yet. A high-pitched whine wheezed out of Harriet. Louis was sure she didn't even know she was making the sound. He grabbed her hands and forced her to meet his gaze. "Harriet, you all right?" She shook her head, tears running. "Harriet, look at me." Louis could see over her shoulder into the hallway. He flicked his glance away from the nurse, scanning for movement, for shadows. 5 minutes passed, or 15, he couldn't tell.
"Dr. Ward," Harriet whispered, "I don't want to die."
He squeezed her hands.
"Harriet, you just keep your eyes right on me. You hear?"
She nodded, swallowed, her eyes fixed on his, wide and brown, trusting. He held her faith tight, even as he saw through his peripheral vision the silhouette that rose behind her in the doorway, the twist of the pistol, the grim slash of a mouth as the man's features came into focus. Louis's leg exploded in pain. The world narrowed to the throb of his thigh and the fire licking through the muscle. Then Harriet fell on top of him. He sucked in the smell of gardenia on her skin, tasted the copper of blood. Footsteps. Closer. Louis pretended to be dead. Or maybe he wished it to be true. He held his breath, waiting to die. He counted to 300. And then he cracked open one eye. The shooter was gone. He found himself looking at Harriet. There was a bullet hole, neat as a thumbtack, in the center of her forehead. A feathered fan of blood sprayed the wall behind her. Louis turned his head and vomited. He pushed himself up on his forearms, intent on hiding, grunting at the pain that tore through his leg. Dr. King's words beat in his head. "If you can't fly, run. If you can't run, walk. If you can't walk, crawl, but by all means, keep moving." Based on the radiating center of the pain and the rhythmic pulse of the bleeding, Louis would guess that he'd been shot in the superficial branch of the femoral artery, that his femur had been shattered. He might be able to crawl somewhere and conceal himself, but he'd bleed out unless he could fix this first. He gritted his teeth and inched forward on his elbows until he could grab the handle of a cabinet. Inside was the sterile tubing used to connect the cannula to the suction machine. He tore the packet with his teeth and tried to tie the clear rubber around his thigh. It was like trying to make a Christmas gift bow alone, though. No matter how hard he worked at it, he couldn't knot it tight enough. And the pain... it was like no pain he'd ever felt. The edges of his vision began to go dark, like the borders at the end of one of those old-time silent movies, just before they shrank into a pinpoint of darkness. Louis's final thought before he passed out was that this was indeed some crazy world, where the waiting period to get an abortion was longer than the waiting period to get a gun. Izzy crept down the hallway, certain that she had fallen into a mirror universe of chaos and discord and gore. The shooter had left macabre breadcrumbs, shattered windows, smears of blood, empty shells. Every instinct told her to turn around and run in the other direction. But she couldn't. It wasn't heroism that drove her toward the supply closet, but the fear of learning that she was not the woman she had always believed herself to be. The procedure room door was ajar, and she could see the rows of glass cabinets filled with gauze and tape. She could also see two bodies. She fell to her knees, rolling the nurse over, feeling for a pulse and finding none. She did the same with the doctor, who moaned, unconscious. He had been shot in the leg and someone had tied plastic tubing around his thigh, a makeshift tourniquet. It had probably saved his life. "Can you hear me?" she asked, as she tried to tighten the tubing. She was attempting to gauge whether she could drag him to safety when she heard the click of the hammer. The shooter stood behind her in the doorway. Izzy froze. He was older than she was, maybe in his 40s. He had brown hair with a neat part. He was wearing a buffalo plaid fleece jacket, even in this infernal heat. He looked ordinary. The kind of man you let cut in the supermarket line because he only had a few items. The kind of man who sat next to you on the bus, said hello, and then left you alone for the rest of the trip. The kind of man you didn't really notice until he stormed into a clinic holding a gun. There had been several times in the past when Izzy believed she might die, when there wasn't food for a whole week, when the heat was cut off and the temperature dipped into the teens. Yet she had known as a kid that there was always something you could do. Eat from the neighbor's trash, sleep in layers of clothes nested between your siblings. As a nurse, she had cheated death on behalf of her patients, reminding a stopped heart of how to beat or breathing for someone with her own lungs. Nothing had prepared her, however, for a situation like this. Izzy wanted to beg for her life, but she couldn't. She was trembling so hard that her mouth wouldn't form words. She wondered if the girl and the woman in the waiting room would survive, if they would tell the press how brave Izzy was, running toward the sound of the gunfire just so that she could help others. She wondered how long it would take before Parker heard. She wondered if the people who would have come to their wedding would come to her funeral instead.
"Get away so I can finish him," the shooter said, and she realized that his weapon was pointed not at her, but at the doctor.
There are moments in your life that change you, like when Izzy stole a hot dog from a gas station because she hadn't eaten in 4 days, when she opened a savings account, when 3 years ago she walked into Parker's cubicle in a hospital. She wasn't going to die without putting up a damn good fight. Izzy threw herself square in front of the doctor's body, spreading her arms as if she could create a shield. The shooter laughed.
"I have enough bullets for you both," he said.
"I can't stop a bullet," Izzy thought, "but I can stop him from firing one." Izzy forced herself to look him in the eye. He was a basilisk. She could be turned to stone. But he was also a gunman in an abortion clinic. Presumably, he was pro-life. She gathered all the threads of courage she could find and drew them together into a fierce knot.
"You can't shoot me," she said. "I'm pregnant."
10 a.m. As Bex pulled into the parking lot of the center, a protester jumped out in front of her car. Bex slammed on the brakes. He shouted, waving his hands over the hood. In the passenger seat, Ren watched, wide-eyed. "I thought you said they had people to help you get inside," Bex said to her niece. "I don't see anyone in a pink penny."
"Maybe it's too early," Ren said, as Bex moved at a snail's pace into the lot.
Ren craned her neck. In the rearview mirror, Bex watched the man go back to the others on the far side of the fence. An elderly lady poured him a cup of coffee from a thermos. Bex pulled into a parking spot and flexed her hand on the steering wheel.
"You could walk me in,"
Ren suggested, her voice small. Bex looked at her, tortured. She'd do anything for Ren. "Honey, I..."
"Forget it. You can wait in the car. It shouldn't take very long."
Bex drew in her breath. "I believe a woman should do whatever she wants with her own body. I do. But I can't say I'd personally make that choice."
"You do remember I'm not here to get an abortion," Ren said.
"Well, of course, but..." She couldn't say what she was thinking. That even if Ren was headed inside for a completely benign reason, there were still other women in there. Maybe women who hadn't had aunts to bring them here, who had run out of options. Women who were creating secrets they would hide from others. It made her sick to her stomach. Ren set her unfinished chocolate cream donut on the console between them.
"Don't get any ideas," she warned.
Bex watched her walk toward the center, but then a truck crossed her field of vision. It stopped dead in front of her mini, blocking her view. Bex honked her horn and gestured, "What the hell?" The man in the truck glanced at her dismissively. She wondered if he was lost. He was alone in the cab. There was no woman with him who might have an appointment. She saw Ren approach the chain-link fence in the line of pro-lifers. One woman leaned over, reaching for her. Oh, hell no. Bex was out of the car and huffing toward the center faster than green grass through a goose. She caught up with Ren and looped her arm around her niece, anchoring her tight to her side. Ren turned, surprised, but...
"No buts," Bex said firmly. "You're not going in there alone."
"You're late," said Helen, the dispatcher, as Hugh walked into the police department. Hugh checked his watch.
"I'm 10 minutes early," he said.
"Not for the staff meeting."
"What staff meeting?"
"The one that's going on in the staff room," Helen replied.
"Shit."
Hugh waited for Helen to buzz him in and then took the stairs two at a time to the basement, where the staff room was. The last time he'd missed a staff meeting, the chief had gone off on him for not taking his position seriously. And how was he supposed to treat Hugh as a de facto second-in-command when he skipped the less glamorous parts of police work? He skidded around the corner, hoping to make an unobtrusive entrance, when he heard the chief's booming voice.
"Finally, Detective McElroy's decided to grace us with his presence. Speaking of presence..."
The whole of the force began to sing happy birthday. His secretary, Paula, held out a platter of donuts arranged into the numbers 4-0. One had a candle stuck in it. Hugh blushed. He hated being the center of attention. He hated birthdays. They were basically markers in the calendar year to renew his license and his registration, and to have an annual checkup. Paula walked toward him and set the platter down on the table so he could blow out his candle.
"Make a wish," she said, standing at his shoulder.
"Who told you it was my birthday?" he said, through a rigid smile.
"Facebook," Paula murmured. "Never should have friended me."
Hugh closed his eyes and made a wish, blew out the candle.
"We all chipped in," one of the junior detectives said, "and we bought you this."
He held up a cane,
decorated with a bright red bow. Everyone laughed, including Hugh.
Thanks. That'll come in handy when I want to beat the crap out of you later.
Paula, the chief said, don't forget to make a prostate exam appointment for our boy.
He clapped Hugh on the shoulder.
All right, grab your donut and let's get back to work. It's not like it's Jesus's birthday, just Hugh's.
Hugh accepted the good wishes of everyone in the department until he was left alone with Paula in the staff room.
You don't look so happy for a birthday, boy, she said.
I'm not a big fan of surprises,
she shrugged.
You know what my husband got me for my 40th? She said,
knocked up.
Hugh laughed.
I don't think that's in the cards for me.
What did you wish?
He opened his mouth, but Paula waved her hand.
No, that was a trick question. You can't tell me, because it won't come true. Honestly, Hugh, have you never had a birthday before?
She handed him a plate with 3 donuts on it.
You get the extra because you're special, but only for today. Don't go letting this get to your head.
She grinned and left him alone in the staff room. He took the candle from the donut on the top. What he'd wished for was, quite simply, the one thing he couldn't have. He wished that everything could stay the way it was, right now, with Ren making him eggs for breakfast and people who cared enough about him at work to throw him a silly party and his health intact. He wished that he could keep getting up morning after morning, with the world remaining unchanged. That was the thing about feeling like life was good, even when it was, especially when it was. You knew you had something to lose. My God, could this be any more embarrassing? Izzy had barely approached the reception desk before a wave of nausea rolled over her. She bolted for the door marked bathroom and had gotten profoundly sick. She wiped her mouth and then took a stack of paper towels, wet them down in the sink, and rubbed them over the clammy skin of her face and neck. There was a knock on the door, and Izzy opened it a crack.
You all right?
Said the woman who had been sitting at the front desk.
I am so sorry, Miss Vanita, she supplied. I am not usually quite so rude, Izzy said.
Vanita passed her a small tin of ginger mints.
These help, she said, matter of fact. When you're ready, come on out and we'll get acquainted.
Izzy closed the door and sat down on the closed toilet seat. She found herself thinking of the time she was in 3rd grade and she didn't have a winter coat. She had gone to the school secretary and told her she needed to check the lost and found, and then she had picked out a coat that didn't belong to her. The worst part was that the school secretary had known damn well it wasn't Izzy's coat. But she didn't say anything. Vanita was being nothing but kind, but there was something in her eyes that made Izzy feel like the other woman already knew all her secrets. Well, Izzy was a nurse. This was not the first time she had faced something new and overwhelming, and it was not the first time she'd had to bluff her way through a situation until confidence caught up to her. She might be in an abortion clinic, but she had been and always would be a survivor. As soon as she had seen the blood, she knew it couldn't be good. Women Olive's age didn't have spotting, especially when they weren't heterosexually active. Add to that the pain she had urinating and the odd numb tingles in her leg, and it was enough for her to go to the center. For years, that was where she had gone for her gynecological checkups. Harriet, the nurse practitioner, had done an exam and then had turned to her.
When was the last time you had a pap smear?
She had asked. Well, long enough that Olive couldn't remember.
Olive, Harriet had said, I think you should see an oncologist.
That had been 2 weeks ago. In the aftermath, She'd had a chest x-ray, an abdominopelvic MRI, a CBC, and an electrolyte and liver series. She had heard what the oncologist said, but maybe she didn't really believe him. Or maybe she needed to hear it from someone she knew and trusted. She sat now in the examination room, waiting for Harriet to come in. The medical file from the gynecological oncologist's office was in her hands. It might as well have been Greek. Fungating mass, exophytic with obstruction of the right pelvic sidewall. Moderate right hydronephrosis, posterior involvement through the rectosigmoid serosal and muscularis. Pelvic and para-aortic lymphadenopathy, no evidence of ascites. Creatinine, 2.4 milligrams/deciliter. Hematocrit, 28%. Hell, Greek would have made more sense to her. The door opened. Olive, Harriet said. How are you feeling? What did the oncologist say? Olive handed her the file.
I should have brought a translator along.
Harriet scanned the papers inside. Neuroendocrine carcinoma of the cervix, she read. Oh, Olive. Carcinoma, Olive repeated. That was the one word I did understand. She shook her head. The doctor talked to me. Well, he talked at me. I just stopped hearing him after a few minutes. You have cervical cancer, Harriet said gently. I'm so sorry. Are you sure it's not a mistake? How could I? I'm a lesbian. Lesbians actually have higher rates of cervical cancer, Harriet said. They don't get monitored because they aren't having penetrative intercourse. There's a certain type that nuns get. Not the kind that's squamous cell cancer, which is associated with HPV, but one even virgins can contract. Well, thankfully, Olive said, I'm not one of those. She looked at the nurse. How bad? It's stage 4, metastatic. Do you know what that means?
It's like winning the lottery,
Olive replied. But Shirley Jackson's kind. Harriet stared at her blankly. Never mind. The nurse looked down at the numbers again. It's in your lungs, possibly in your liver. It's blocking your right kidney. She looked Olive in the eye. I'm gonna level with you. It's unlikely that someone whose cancer has spread this far can be cured. I'm sure there are things the oncologist can do to help you have a good quality of life, but you should get your affairs in order. Olive felt her mouth go dry as dust. She, who always had a witty retort, had nothing to say. How long? She finally managed. 6 to 8 months, I'm guessing. I hate to say that, Olive, and I hope to hell I'm wrong. But if I were you, I'd want someone to tell me the truth. Olive sat in the stew of that information, sinking in her own sudden, inevitable mortality. She felt Harriet's arms come around her, hold her tightly. This was why she had come to the center. She knew already what was hiding inside that medical folder. She had just not wanted to face it alone. There was a sharp rap on the door, and then Dr. Ward stuck his head inside.
Harriet, it's go time.
He smiled at Olive and closed the door again. Olive had so many questions. Was it her fault? Some deficiency in diet or some promiscuity in college that had led to this. How would she tell Peg? Would it happen fast or would it be a slow decline? Would it hurt? Would she still be herself at the end? Harriet stepped back, still holding Olive's hands. She gave them a final squeeze.
I need to go assist. You gonna be all right?
She left without hearing Olive's response, but they both knew the answer anyway. When Ren had started high school 2 months ago, she suffered the usual freshman pranks, being told there was a pool in the basement when there wasn't, finding shaving cream in her locker, being squirted with water guns as she walked down the foreign language hallway. She learned pretty fast which routes through the school were safe and which ones weren't. The place she hated the most, however, was the pit, which was an outside corridor connecting two arms of the building where the smokers hung out between classes. She'd run the gauntlet, knowing these kids smelled her fear and her naivete, and were making up their minds about her without knowing her at all. That's what it felt like now, walking past the line of protesters. Some of them smiled at her, even as they waved posters of bloody babies in her face. Some chanted Dr. Seuss, "A person's a person, no matter how small."
"Can you come here for a sec?"
one woman said, with the kind of apologetic smile you use when you are truly sorry about asking for help because your car is broken down on the side of the road, or your phone is dead and you need to call home, or you are juggling too many groceries in your arms and wishing you'd been smart enough to take a basket. Instinct tugged her in that direction because Ren had always been a good girl. The woman had red hair and funky purple glasses and looked incredibly familiar. But Ren couldn't place her. Still, she didn't want to run the risk that the woman might recognize her, too. What if she worked at the police department or something and spilled this secret to her dad? So she ducked her head as the woman stuffed a little goodie bag in her hand, like the kind you got at a kid's birthday party. Just then, her aunt was glued to her side. "You're not going in there alone," Bex said. And Ren wrapped her arms around her aunt's neck and hugged her tight. Ren knew it made her sound like a total bitch, but she didn't really pine for her mom. Part of it was because her mother had left when Ren was little. Part of it was because of her aunt, who filled in any empty spaces. Aunt Bex had sewed her a colonial dress for the American Revolution unit they'd done in second grade. Well, she'd hot glued it. She wasn't particularly good with a needle. She had never missed a t-ball game and brought sweet tea for all the other parents. She even hung Ren's lame watercolors on her wall, she, who was an artist and knew damn well they were terrible. It seemed to Ren that having a mother had a lot less to do with a few sweaty hours of labor and delivery, and a lot more to do with whose face you always looked for in a crowd. As if she needed any more proof, here was Bex beside her, even though Ren knew how much it cost her. She knew Aunt Bex had never had children, and that fact maybe even had something to do with her aversion to the center. But in a way, Ren was secretly glad Bex belonged only to her. By the time they were buzzed inside, sweat had broken out between Ren's shoulder blades. "You sit down," Ren told her aunt. "I can check myself in." There were a few people in the waiting room, and a television was on with the sound muted. At the reception desk sat a woman with the most stunning tower of braids Ren had ever seen. Thick red and black snakes twined around each other. She wore a name tag that read Vanita, and she was on the telephone. She smiled at Ren and held up a finger, suggesting she'd only be another moment. "In the state of Mississippi, it's a 2-day process." "That's right." "So Thursday would be your counseling session, your lab work, and a sonogram. The next day, when you have your procedure, you'll be here from 1.5 to 3 hours. If you want to schedule an appointment, I can help you with that now." She paused, then picked up a pen. "Name? Age?
Date of last period? Good contact phone number. So you're scheduled for Thursday at 9 a.m. Now, write down your appointment date and time because we can't verify if you call back and ask when it is for confidentiality reasons. You have to bring $150 and your photo ID, cash or card. No large bags, no purses, no kids. All right, then. You're welcome. She hung up the phone and smiled at Ren. Sorry about that. How can I help you? I'm here for an appointment, Ren said, and then hastily, but not like the kind you just scheduled. My name's Ren McElroy.
Ren. Ren.
The woman scanned a list. With a W.
Ah, here you are.
Benita checked her in and handed her a clipboard.
Just fill out this form for me, and we'll get you in as soon as possible.
Ren sat across from the television. She scribbled down her information, the usual stuff. Name, address, age, allergies. Beside her, Aunt Bex was going through the little goodie bag Ren had been handed by the protester. Smarties. Chapstick. A pair of tiny blue knit booties.
Well, those are sweet, Bex said.
She dug out hand sanitizer, breath mints, and two small soaps.
Maybe they think we're all dirty, Ren said.
She plucked the flyer from the little bag and began to read.
Please don't rush into this decision. Abortion is forever.
If you are in an abortion center right now, you can just leave. You don't have to tell anyone. If you've already paid, we can help you get your money back. Ren opened the pamphlet. There were pictures of gummy, bright-eyed babies. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you.
God. Do you think that's a direct quote?
Bex asked, reading over her shoulder. Ren stifled a laugh.
My history teacher would not accept that citation.
On the back panel was a list of the alleged consequences of chemical and surgical abortion. Perforated uterus, chronic and acute infections, intense pain, excessive bleeding requiring transfusion, risk of future miscarriages, infertility, cancer, death. Feelings of guilt, anger, helplessness, mental breakdown, depression, nightmares and flashbacks, inability to feel joy about life, feeling of separation from God, fear of not being forgiven, alienation from family and friends, loss of relationship with boyfriend or spouse, promiscuity, drug abuse, suicide. It reminded Ren of those ads on television for antidepressants. Yeah, we'll stop those mood troughs, but you might wind up incontinent, with high blood pressure, with increased suicidal tendencies, or, hey, dead. Ren looked at the bold type at the bottom.
You are not alone. We care about you.
Suddenly, she remembered where she had seen that red-headed woman. She was the parent of a ninth grader, and she had raised holy hell over a unit in health class where they studied contraceptive options. The day Ren had to roll a condom onto a banana, the woman had barged into the room, spewing craziness about impressionable minds and God and the rhythm method. Ren had felt bad for her son, who was moved to the library during health from then on. Ren shook her head, now that she realized that this woman who was anti-contraception was also anti-abortion. Wasn't that counterintuitive? If you didn't want abortions, shouldn't you at least be throwing free condoms and birth control pills out to anyone who would take them? Shouldn't that woman have been cheering for Ren to come to the center and get the pill,
instead of berating her? Ren looked down at the pamphlet again.
We care about you.
Or not. She walked across the room and tossed it into the trash.
Daddy?
Beth cried.
Daddy?
Frustration foamed in her father's wake, but he didn't look back as he left. He nearly mowed down the nurse, hurrying to get away from her, away from what she had done. Jayla peered at her.
You okay?
She asked gently. Beth shook her head, unable to speak. The nurse sat down on the edge of Beth's bed.
I didn't mean to eavesdrop, she said, but it's pretty hard when the door's wide open.
She hesitated.
The ER isn't my usual rotation, you know. I work on the ortho floor, but I'm covering for a colleague who needed a personal day. So, I'm not sure what the protocol is here.
Beth wiped her eyes.
What do you mean?
Well, in ortho, if I found out my patient is an intravenous drug user or has some other history she didn't disclose to the doctors, I'd tell my supervisor. It could be a matter of life or death. What I'm trying to say is that you really do need to tell me the truth.
She looked at Beth.
So, she said, which is it?
Beth blinked at her. She felt the walls pressing in.
You told me you didn't know you were pregnant, but I just heard you tell your father you went to an abortion clinic.
Beth flushed.
I want my father.
If you had a surgical abortion and it didn't go right, and that's what's caused the bleeding, your health could be in danger. Beth, you could die.
Beth wiped her eyes with the corner of the hospital, Johnny.
I did go to the clinic, she admitted, but they said they couldn't help me unless I went to a judge. So I filled out all the forms and got a hearing scheduled, and then I got a call saying the judge couldn't see me for 2 weeks.
She looked up at Jayla.
I couldn't wait that long and then go back to the clinic. It would be too late.
Beth started to cry so hard she couldn't catch her breath.
I didn't have a choice,
she sobbed, curling into herself, making a shell of her own body.
You get that, right?
Jayla stroked her back.
Okay, she said. Okay. Deep breaths.
If only they had used a condom. If only she wasn't under 18. If only the judge had shown up when he was supposed to. If only she had lived in Boston or New York, where there wasn't just one clinic, but many. If only it hadn't been so damn hard to fix this on her own. If only she'd kept the baby. The thought crawled into her mind like a spider. She would still have faced her father's anger. She would still have been a whore, in his eyes. For all she knew, he would have thrown her out. For all she knew, he still might. That made her cry even harder, which was why she did not hear Jayla slip into the hallway, take out her cell phone, and call her husband.
Nathan, the nurse said, I need your help.
Janine sat on the examination table, panicking. It was one thing to come into the center using a fake ID, register for an abortion, and sit through a counseling session, but it was another thing entirely to dodge the state-mandated ultrasound. Somehow she needed to get the evidence she had come here for. Just last month, in another state, a pro-life girl had gone into a clinic undercover like Janine and had told a counselor that she was 13 and her boyfriend was 25 and she wanted an abortion. The counselor had said on tape, I didn't hear that. The damning audio had made the rounds of the internet and had even aired on Hannity. Janine heard the quick knock and slipped her phone into her dress pocket, hitting the record button on the voice memo just as the door swung open. The social worker smiled.
"Hello there," she said. "I'm Graciela. So, we're going to do your ultrasound, right?"
Janine felt herself break into a sweat. She needed to get this woman talking.
"Wait," she blurted out. "I have allergies."
"To latex?"
Janine swallowed.
"To, like, everything. I forgot to write it down."
Graciela made a note in her file and then turned on the ultrasound machine. It hummed alive, as if they were all an orchestra, and this was the note they must become attuned to.
"What if I don't want an ultrasound?"
Janine asked.
"I'm afraid you don't have a choice. The state says I have to do one today and ask you if you'd like to see it. You can't say no if you want."
Graciela paused, her hand holding the wand.
"You seem a little nervous."
In any other situation, Janine would have thought, "This woman is kind." But although Graciela might still be a lovely human being, it didn't change the fact that she had made the choice to work at an abortion factory. It wasn't like you could get prenatal care here if you wanted it. The last undercover spy that Alan had sent into the clinic had worn glasses with a tiny camera in the bridge of the nose, and she had video of this very woman saying, no, they did not offer pregnancy care, but could refer her to a place that did. They really shouldn't call themselves a reproductive health care center if they weren't willing to help women reproduce. Once she had been in a clinic like this, not as a spy, but as a patient. Did she have an ultrasound there? Why couldn't she remember? It was not until Graciela handed her a Kleenex that she realized she was crying.
"Are you nervous?"
"That I can fix," the social worker said. "But if you're crying because you don't know if you've made the right decision, that I can't help you with."
Janine thought of the voice recording in her pocket, closed her eyes, and prayed for something to happen. Anything that might incriminate Graciela before Janine was incriminated herself. 15 weeks was the trickiest. When Louis had a patient come in 15 weeks pregnant, he knew he was in for a challenge. The fetus's bones would have just started to calcify, so it would have to be disarticulated. The way Louis explained it, it was that the uterus was like an ice cream cone. Imagine you had an Oreo at the top and needed to get it through the bottom of the cone. Of course, you had to break it into parts. In Mississippi, there was an additional wrinkle. By law, you could not use forceps while a fetus still had a heartbeat. This law was passed by non-scientists who believed that fetuses at 16 weeks could feel pain, which they could not. But as a result of political posturing, Louis had to amend his procedure, adding extra steps that might cause more risk to the patient, instead of doing what was best for her. That meant Louis would start with an ultrasound. Cytotec caused sustained uterine contractions, which meant that most of the fetuses would be asystolic due to the constant squeezing. But if that wasn't the case, if there still was a heartbeat visible on the ultrasound, it was up to Louis to use suction to bring the umbilical cord down and transect it to end cardiac activity. Louis told the patient none of this. He looked at Joy Perry, who was his primary concern for the next quarter of an hour. Like all his 15 and 16 week patients, she was the first and last procedure of the day. She had come early for the Cytotec, 800 micrograms in pill form, which were inserted by him vaginally to make the cervix pliable. Now she was lying back, her pale hair in a ponytail that spilled over the edge of the procedure table, like the tassels on his grandmama's brocade curtains. He met her gaze through the valley of her bent knees.
"This is going to take about 7 minutes," Louis said. "We're going to get you through."
He glanced at Harriet, his nurse du jour. He'd worked with Harriet long enough to have a shorthand with her, but truth be told, Louis flew to 7 different clinics throughout the South and Plain states, and he was used to working with a rotating panel of RNs and nurse practitioners. They were all exceptional, standing by the side of the women on his procedure table, providing him with a syringe of lidocaine when he needed it, and a gentle whisper of support when his patient did. A flick of Louis's eyes to the right, and Harriet took Joy's hand in her own and squeezed. He touched her knee.
"Wait!"
Joy cried, and Louis lifted his hand immediately, 5 fingers outstretched.
I didn't shave," she murmured.
Louis stifled a grin. If he had a dime for every time he'd heard that. He knew what it was like to be in the dentist's chair and wonder if you had a booger in your nose. He understood what it was to be a patient and vulnerable. Time to administer some vocal local. In Mississippi, he wasn't allowed to give any narcotics, not even Xanax, to relax a patient.
"Now, Ms. Harriet," he said in an exaggerated tone, "didn't I tell you not to bring me any more ladies who didn't get a Brazilian before coming here?"
He saw it, the tiny crack of a grin on Joy's face.
"You're going to feel a little pressure."
Louis pressed the inside of the patient's thigh.
"Just like that. I'm going to put the speculum inside now. You relax that muscle. There you go. Where are you from?"
"Pearl."
"Right next door."
When Louis chatted through the procedure, he wasn't trivializing. He was normalizing the moment, putting it into context. He wanted the woman to know this abortion was a sliver of her life and not the benchmark upon which she should judge herself. As he yammered about the traffic in Jackson, Louis wrapped a ball of gauze on the tenaculum and swabbed Joy's cervix with betadine. Harriet, his partner in this dance, smoothly held up the lidocaine vial while he filled the syringe.
"Little pinch coming. Give me a cough now."
As Joy coughed, Louis grabbed the edge of the cervix with the tenaculum and injected the lidocaine at several spots around the ring of tissue. He felt the muscles of her thighs tense.
"You know, people who can cough on demand can also fake things. Did you used to fake tears to get your mama not to spank you?"
Louis asked. Joy shook her head.
"Well, I used to do that. Worked every time."
He reached to his left for one of the metal dilation rods and inserted it into the cervix and then out. Then a slightly larger one, and another after that, all the way up to 15 millimeters as the cervix opened like the shutter of a camera.
"So, were you born in Pearl?"
"No. Yazoo."
"Yazoo," Louis said. "That's the place with the witch."
Sometimes he thought he knew more about the states where he performed abortions than their own residents did. He had to, for moments like this.
"The what?"
She flinched.
"You're doing great, Joy. There was some swamp witch who lived in Yazoo during the 1800s. You really never heard about her?"
Louis asked.
"You're gonna feel fluid now. That's normal."
He ruptured her membranes and leaned back as a gush of blood and amniotic fluid spilled between her legs into the tray beneath. Some splattered on his sneaker.
"She died in quicksand, I guess, when the police were after her. Just before she passed, she vowed she'd come back in 20 years to haunt the town and burn it to the ground."
Louis glanced up.
"A A little pulling now. Just breathe. All I'm doing is maneuvering around inside your uterus and using the ultrasound to guide me.
From the corner of his eye, he watched Joy's fingers grasp Harriet's more firmly. He bent his head, intent on his work, taking the fetus out with forceps. He pulled out clots of pink tissue, some recognizable, some not. At this stage of pregnancy, the calvarium was just solid enough to not collapse with suction. If it got up into the high corner of the uterus, it had a tendency to roll around like a beach ball. In with the forceps, out again. A miniature hand, a knee. In and out, in and out. The G-clef of a spine. The squash blossom calvarium.
Anyway, 20 years later, in 1900, there was a freak fire in the town that burned 100 buildings and 200 homes. The townspeople went to the grave of the swamp witch, and sure enough, the tombstone was broken and the chain around her grave was all torn up. Spooky as hell, right? Now, just another minute.
Louis knew exactly what it meant to disrupt a life process. At 5 weeks, he'd see nothing but a tiny sac. At 6 weeks, a fetal pole with cardiac activity, but no limb buds, no thorax, no calvarium. By 9 weeks, there were differentiated body parts, tiny arms, tiny hands, the black spot of an emerging eye. At the 15-week mark, like today's procedure, the calvarium had to be crushed to fit through a 15-millimeter cannula. As a provider, you could not unfeel that moment. And yet, was it a person? No. It was a piece of life, but so was a sperm, an egg. If life began at conception, what about all those eggs and sperm that didn't become babies? What about the fertilized eggs that didn't implant, or the ones that did, ectopically? What about the zygote that failed to thrive when implanted and was sloughed off with the uterine lining? Was that a death? Up till 22 weeks of pregnancy, a fetus wouldn't survive without a host, even on a respirator. Between 22 and 25 weeks, a fetus might live briefly with severe brain and organ damage. The American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists did not recommend resuscitating babies born at 23 weeks. At 24 weeks, it was up to the parents and doctors to decide together. At 25 weeks, the American Medical Association suggested resuscitation, but also said that the ability to survive was not a sure thing. There were plenty of babies diagnosed late in the second trimester with anomalies that were incompatible with life. If those babies were born past 29 weeks, they would feel pain when they died. In those cases, was abortion murder or mercy? If you decided this was an exceptional case, what about if the mother was a heroin addict? What if her husband beat her so bad she broke bones several times a year? Was it ethical for that woman to carry a baby to term? He got it. He really did. In that boggy mess of blood and tissue were recognizable parts. They were familiar enough to be upsetting. The bottom line was this: a zygote, an embryo, a fetus, a baby. They were all human. But at what point did that human deserve legal protection?
We're in the home stretch now.
Louis turned on the suction and swept the cannula along the uterus.
You never heard that story about the witch.
She shook her head.
And you call yourself a Yazooite?
Louis joked.
What do people from Yazoo call themselves?
Cursed. Joy said.
He laughed. I knew I liked you.
Louis felt for the familiar grittiness of the uterine wall that let him know he was done. Whether or not you believed a fetus was a human being, there was no question in anyone's mind that a grown woman was one. Even if you placed moral value on that fetus, you couldn't give it rights unless they were stripped away from the woman carrying it. Perhaps the question wasn't when does a fetus become a person, but when does a woman stop being one? Louis glanced down at the tissue in the tray between his patient's legs. The contents of the tray were swirled and amorphous, like a galaxy without stars. It was part of his job as a physician. If all the products of conception couldn't be accounted for, then there would be infection later. It was also philosophically important to him as an abortion provider to recognize the procedure for what it was, instead of using euphemisms. He finished his silent count of limbs and landmarks. He could feel Joy's womb starting to shrink back down. He stood so that he could look his patient in the eye, so she would know he had seen her, not just as a patient, but as the woman she was and would be when she walked out that door.
You, he told Joy, are no longer pregnant.
The woman closed her eyes. Thank you, she murmured. Louis gently patted her knee.
Miss Joy, he said simply, you don't have to be grateful for something that you're right.
How was it, Joy wondered, that she was ending a pregnancy and talking about ghosts? Maybe it wasn't all that far off the mark. She knew there were all sorts of things that could come back to haunt you. She felt cramping, and she winced. She could still hear the whir of the machine that did the suction. It seemed like an oversight. Surely they could have given her headphones, like the kind they had on planes that canceled out all the noise, or piped in heavy metal music so that you wouldn't have to lie here and listen to the sound of your pregnancy ending. Maybe that was the point. They didn't want to make it easy. They wanted you doing this with your eyes and your legs wide open. Joy stared at the ceiling at a Where's Waldo poster, where there were 1,000 penguins wearing red and white scarves and one lone guy in a striped hat. Why would you try to find Waldo? Let the poor guy stay lost. The suction was a choke, a throttle, a throat clearing. Little vacuum, Joy thought, cleaning up her mess. 9 a.m. Hugh was painting with water. That's what he called police work that was not only painfully boring, but ultimately a complete waste of time. Today, it was processing a 2010 Toyota RAV4 that had been taken for a joyride after its owner, a college kid, left the keys in the ignition. It had been found off the side of the road, dented and reeking of pot. Christ, he didn't have to be a detective to figure out what had happened here, or to realize that the amount of time that Hugh spent processing the car and the scene, a dusty ditch off the side of the highway, was going to exceed the value of the check the insurance company would eventually send the owner for repairs. Who wanted to spend his 40th birthday getting the fingerprints off a stolen vehicle? He sighed as he attempted to dust the interior. It never worked because of the texture of the dashboard, but if he didn't do it, he'd be told he had overlooked evidence. He'd already photographed the vehicle 360 degrees and also taken pictures of the tracks in the grass made by the tires. He had noted how far back the seat was reclined, what station the radio was tuned to, what detritus lived in the console. Later today, he would have the dubious honor of contacting the car's owner and giving him this list. Gum. Kind bar. Water bottle.
keychain, baseball cap, receipts from a Piggly Wiggly, junk mail, and then asked the guy what was missing. Hugh would bet his house that the owner wouldn't be able to